And good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're streaming live at KUCI.org, and today is Wednesday, January 15th, 2020. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Today, my guests are literary agent Danielle Svetkov and crime novelist Matt Coyle. First up is literary agent Danielle Svetkov with the Levine Greenberg Rostin Literary Agency. Before becoming an agent, she wrote for the New York Times, U.S. News and World Report, the Chicago Tribune Magazine, and others. She has a debut novel, Parked, coming out soon. We'll talk about this and more. Hi, Danielle.
Hi.
Hi, great to have you on.
Thanks for inviting me.
So there was a little bit there about you prior to becoming an agent, but will you go a bit more into it, how you found your way to agenting?
Yeah, it was a little by accident, a little by necessity, a little by fantasy. I think there are a couple movies and maybe books where agents are portrayed, and I probably took that in and thought it sounded interesting. And then when I was a freelance writer for years, and then I got my MFA in fiction. And after I got that MFA in fiction from Warren Wilson College, which is a great low residency program in North Carolina, I thought, oh, I can't hawk stories anymore to magazines and newspapers. I'm a writer with a capital W. And so I wrote sort of my short stories in obscurity, and then I realized, wait, I'm totally irrelevant. I have to find my relevancy again. So I answered an ad on Craigslist for a part-time agent assistant, and I continued writing my short stories. But what was wonderful about getting the job with the literary agency is that I got a view of how it worked on the inside that I'd never really had. Even when I was freelance writing for newspapers and magazines, I didn't get the inside view. And it's very important to get if you can get it. And that's how it happened. And then I started doing more and more for the agency. I was book doctoring. And then they said, you should start selling books. And so I did. And that's the short version.
Now, are you a San Francisco satellite for a New York agency?
Yes, that's exactly correct.
So tell me how that works.
So it works brilliantly. I've always been out here. The agent I assisted had moved out here from the New York office. And the way it works is I go to New York a few times a year to visit my colleagues at Levine Greenberg, and it's kind of a booster shot. It's a very collaborative agency, and so I go, we catch up, I meet with editors when I'm there, and then I come back here, and I look for, it's not that I exclusively look for clients west of the Mississippi River, but it works out that way, which is great, because so much of publishing and the conversation is happening in New York, or it seems like it's happening in New York, but it's happening everywhere. And so I like having access in California to all the writers out here who don't get to visit their agents all the time if they have New York agents. And I can't tell you how many writers I've found who got frustrated with that relationship where they could try to reach their agent by phone in New York, but they struggled, and then they finally got frustrated and left them and then came knocking on my door. So most of my clients now are Bay Area-based or California-based or West Coast-based, a lot in Portland as well. So it works out brilliantly.
It's really kind of interesting, because when the show began, which was, 22 years ago, I remember having agents on, and there were so few out here that really garnered any respect in New York. And now there's so many of you, which is just, of course, it shows how things have changed, but it's also so wonderful for West Coast writers who, as you said, you know, it's like that frustration with New York and then wanting to have maybe a closer relationship or being able to meet once in a while with your agent. You don't get back east. Yeah.
Yeah. And also I think we're different out here, and I think certain authors want that difference. We're a little maybe less crazed. We're not quite as attached to certain, whatever the hallmarks of a perfect writer are in New York. We're looking for perfect means something else in different places. So, and I think authors respond to that. And I also should say, in the last 22 years since you've been doing your show. You know, Chronicle Books has risen, 10 Speed has risen. They were all here, but they've all gotten bigger. Mm-hmm. Harper One, which is an imprint at HarperCollins, has been out here for years, but it's risen, and now it's more prominent. So all of those are in the Bay Area. And there are actually editors from Hachette here, which is Little Brown, DeCapo. So they're actually there's quite an established group of editors and agents out here. Still not droves and droves, but I don't know. I kind of like it. I feel like we're the rebel force. So.
I love that.
Yeah.
So what kind of stuff do you look for? What do you represent?
I represent mostly nonfiction, although I like to do a novel or two a year. On my little bio page on the agency website, I describe my favorite kind of nonfiction writer is the irreverent reverent, which is my shorthand for someone who is deep in their subject matter, and so deep in that they see some of the rhetoric around it has gotten a little wonky, and they poke at it and kind of explode it, and they manage to have some humor but a ton of authority on their subject. Those are some of my favorites. And those writers are often writing in first person out of necessity because they are part of the story. That's not entirely what I'm doing, and it's not necessarily, you know, not all the nonfiction I do falls into that category, but I feel like I have a chemical attachment to those kind of writers, and I can spot them from, 200 miles away. And then I love representing journalists generally because I was one, and I went to journalism. I have an undergrad degree from the Medill School of Journalism, where the mantra was, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. I just love the rigor of that work, and it's so hard. And what they find when they go down the rabbit hole is so wonderful. And it, you know, people say, you know, nonfiction these days can be just as story-driven mm-hmm. as fiction, and I agree. It's when you get enough detail, and when life is stranger than fiction, it absolutely can be. So that's probably the short description of what I'm after. And the fiction authors I chase tend to be really quirky. I really like oddball protagonists, and I really love ensemble novels where you're in a strange town with strangers who love each other. That's kind of who love each other in strange ways. That's very much the definition of my fictional pursuits.
Now, it's interesting that you went for nonfiction, representing nonfiction, because, yeah, you are a journalist, but you said you have your MFA in fiction.
Yes. No, it is. You're right. Right. You caught me.
So what about that?
Well, you know, fiction is very hard to sell, and when I started in the business, I think the most successful fiction agents apprentice to fiction agents, and I didn't apprentice to a fiction agent. I apprenticed to a nonfiction agent. And so I began in the business understanding that. And what I've learned about fiction as I've gone, I've learned from almost by accident. And now I have much more fiction under my belt. But the fiction agents are almost all exclusively fiction. And so it's just a learning curve. And I'd still love to, you know, though I've been doing this almost 17 years, I'd still love to sit at the knee of fiction agents and learn from them. And I have wonderful colleagues in New York, and that's exclusively what they do. And I wish I could sit next to them every day. And I think part of it also is that it's hard to represent something that I am trying to do myself, because I get very involved. And some of the projects that I've represented, some of the fiction, you know, we've edited for years, which is not uncommon, actually, for fiction agents to edit and work with an author for years. But I think it was harder for me because I had projects I wanted to work on, too. So I think the church and state has made it easier for me as a writer to say the nonfiction is over here and the fiction is over there, and I'm with the fiction on my private time, mm-hmm. and I'm with the nonfiction mm-hmm. on my public work time.
Sure.
So that's some of it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I am with Danielle Svetkov. She is with Levine Greenberg, Roston Literary Agency in New York. So, and you have a novel coming out, Parked.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, that, it started many years ago, actually, probably right when I started representing authors. I started tooling around with it, and the seed of it was I'm a big walker, and I was, when I still lived in San Francisco, I would walk all over the city, and there was one walk I did that would go from Noe Valley to the Marina, which is almost the entire city, and people would always mm-hmm. say, oh, God, that's such a long walk, and I'd say, no, it only takes an hour, but when I would get to the Marina, you know, it's stunning. You see the Golden Gate Bridge, and you see Alcatraz, and it's just gorgeous. The bay is sparkling. And then right when I reached my destination, which was right in front of Fort Mason, I would see this line of vans, and they had the best views in the entire city. But it was a line of vans, and people were living in those vans, and the vans were really falling apart with cracked windshields and broken antenna and laundry lines. And I thought, this is insane. The city is insane that, you know, you have people who understand its beauty and want to be here, but they can't afford to be here, but they park their cars in the most beautiful spot in the city. And I don't remember thinking I have to write a book about it, but at some point I did, and I started, and I decided to put a mother and a daughter in my fictional van, and it's at the front of the line of those vans. And the city is, you know, haunted by its homeless and those who are living in housing that is really not suited for long term. And so clearly all of that came to play in my subconscious and started mixing up a story stew. And then I started thinking about how I wanted to handle it. And I kept thinking, I don't know if the adult in me wants to tell this story as much as the kid, because it's the kid who grew up being told by adults, you know, don't look, it's too hard to look at, and that'll never happen to you, so don't worry. And I remember thinking as a kid, well, why won't it happen to me, and why mm-hmm. did it happen to them? And mm-hmm. and the things that the adults were saying didn't make me feel better. And so I just decided that this was going to be a children's story, and I was going to pick away at the question of why did it happen to them? What is going on, and what is a child's role if it's happening to a child or if a child's seeing it? And that's sort of the story, is take a young girl living in one of those vans and a boy living in a lovely house across the way and have them have an unlikely friendship and figure things out about each other.
Mm. And when does it come out?
February 4th.
Very cool. And who is the publisher?
Dial Books for Young Readers, which is part of Penguin Random. And it's been an amazing experience. I have sat sidecar on so many author editor experiences, mm-hmm. and I don't know how I scored the best one, but I did. So it's been great.
So did you agent your own book?
No, my colleague Carrie Sparks, who is our YA middle grade agent at the agency, represented it.
I'm always curious about that when agents write books. If they agent their own books, or it seems like hardly ever, right?
No, it would be nuts to try to represent yourself. I mean, there's a reason authors have agents, and it's not just to sell it. It is to hold the hand. You know, there's so much armchair psych involved in mm-hmm. being an agent, mm-hmm. and it's important. You need an advocate that's not your husband or your best friend, it's someone, and not your editor, it's someone who's between you and the publishing house, who understands, you know, generally what it is to be an author, who understands what's going on internally at the publishing house, and who understands you.
Right.
Which is why I always get frustrated when I hear from authors that they can't reach their agents. I think, well, what else is the agent?
Right.
What's their role? But, you know, then you've basically hired someone who's just a transactional agent. And you know, some people just want that, but most people don't. Most people want all the other stuff that an agent can and should do.
Yeah, yeah. So then how does self-publishing strike you? I mean, will you ever get submissions of formerly self-published books or queries that say, I've self-published this and I'm looking for an agent for this? And mm-hmm. and what do you do with that?
Well, I look at it first on the merits of the project. Is do I like the writing? That's always my first question. And then I want to hear the backstory of how it did as a self-published project. We kind of treat it as any query comes in. You know, people, it's so easy to throw up your book on Amazon or wherever just as a exercise that it seems unfair to judge it as less than another person who has a book but decided not to put it up. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're the same, and I judge them the same. Is it good? Do I like it? Is it my kind of book? I don't see that much self-published nonfiction, so I'm not dealing with it mm-hmm. that often. Like I said, I'm mostly doing nonfiction. And the few times I met a woman at the library, my local library, who'd recently published with a tiny, tiny press, and she'd won an award for her novel, and she wanted to get it at a bigger press. And I told her I didn't think I was the suitable agent for it, but I'd be happy to help her if she couldn't find a suitable agent, because she just wanted to find out if I could sell the audio rights. And anyway, long story short, I ended up selling the audio rights, helping her move this basically self-published book to a much bigger press. And, you know, it just depends on how things happen and whether I feel I can enter it and whether I think I can help.
That's interesting. What about... a couple of things. One is hybrid publishing, which seems to be happening more and more, where you usually smaller presses where you don't get an advance, but they share in the royalties with you, something like that.
Mm-hmm. You're wondering, tell me your question.
Well, I guess my question is that, will you deal with hybrid publishers? Is that something really a writer should do on his or her own?
Well, I think it depends on the profit share, too. I mean, mm-hmm. if you're dealing with a publisher who's not going to pay you anything and then is going to pay you standard royalties, I would hesitate.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they're going to pay you nothing, then at least you should get better on the back end,
right?
You know, better than 10%, 12%, and 15% as things rise.
Mm-hmm.
By the same token, if they have a good track, if they know how to sell books, if they've proven to, like, if it's a genre publisher and they know how to reach people who love that genre, you might consider it. But, you know, you also have to decide if they do nothing but make a pretty cover for you and they're not distributing you that well and your alternative is self-publishing and you think that you're a dynamo and you're going to get out there and do a ton, then you would be better off self-publishing and keeping your 33% or whatever Amazon is paying self-published author now, and owning it and owning your district, you know, being in control. So,
mm-hmm.
I think in a way it's an accounting question and it's an assessment of your own skills as a marketer, because at both places you're probably going to do the bulk of the publicity and marketing. And if that's the case, and you're not getting that much from your hybrid publisher, then you have to ask why. Is it because the editor's really nice and you like talking to them on the phone and they're giving you what an agent would give you or an editor would give you? They're giving you a sense that you're not alone? Well, maybe that's worth something.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be that it's not worth enough.
What about anthologies? It seems that anthologies are kind of seeing some sort of resurgence. And do you handle anthologies?
I have not handled an anthology. I would not say they're having a resurgence, but I feel like they're always out there. A few come out every year, and I would happily represent one if it made sense to me. I think the best ones have an occasion connected to them, so an anthology of mothers writing about motherhood has the occasion of Mother's Day to sell on.
Right.
An anthology about Christmas sadness would sell at Christmas, you know. So I think they do best when they are giftable, because you're not buying them because you love all the authors. You're usually buying them because the subject matter is connected to something you're interested in, and there are a few writers in the collection that you know, and I often see them gifted, you know, not necessarily. So, yes, the short answer is yes.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
I don't think I've exactly thought of that, having them kind of, you know, pointed to a holiday or an occasion or an anniversary or something going on in the world.
Yeah.
And we have a few minutes left with Danielle Svetkov. I want to ask you, I imagine that relationships with writers begin with a query letter?
Most of the time, unless you meet them at the local library, like I said. You know, but I do always recommend writers. I go to a few conferences a year. Most agents go to a few conferences a year. And they're so great for cutting through all of that invisibility, which is like a layer of fat when you query someone, right? Because you query blind, usually. You don't know the person. So you have to be a really good letter writer who manages to convey your personality, your book idea, all in this tight, economical, beautiful letter. And when you meet an agent at a conference, the first line of your query letter can be, hey, I met you, I had red hair, I was the one who made that funny joke, or hey, I had the British accent and I met you. And then your letter doesn't have to be quite so perfect because you have this, you're triggering the agent, right, I met you and I remember you and I'm going to pay attention a little bit more, I'm going to give this what it's due on this, you know, because, and not to say that that's not happening with every query, but we read fast. And honestly, we are looking for an excuse to delete the email because we're overwhelmed with email. And so if you can make this overture in the opening line that says, you know, we met before and all of that, you just got so much more of my attention and less of that instinct to find a flaw is playing in my head at that moment, which is good. All that's good. So
great.
I do recommend authors make... go to a conference a year or find one nearby and meet an agent. It's a good idea.
Yeah, that's great. That was the follow-up question. So I'm glad you talked about that because referrals or meeting can really kind of do wonders. And it also is important, I think, for writers to be literary citizens, right, and participate.
Yeah. And I mean, you can go to those conferences. A writer can go to those conferences. And if, let's say, you don't meet an agent, but you meet another writer who has an agent or who has done a ton of querying or has done a ton of conferences, you just made another good contact because you can say to that, you can have an email friendship with that person for a long time, and as they're, you know, as they rise, you'll rise because you'll be hearing from them. Oh, yeah, definitely sign with Danielle. She's great. Definitely don't sign with so-and-so.
There, right.
You know, or so-and-so wrote me this kind of letter. I learned this from that agent. I'm passing this information on to you, friend, who I met at that conference. So there's so much, yes, you've got to get out of the house. You've got to get out from behind the computer a little bit. There's got to be some, you know, pressing of the flesh. Meet some people. Try to have a writing group. Try not to be alone. It's a lonely business as it is. And if you can make it unlonely for the parts that are meant to be communal, do. Try to meet people. It's so helpful. There's, so, you know, I have authors who are endlessly successful, but they still have lows because it is, in the end, it's one author usually and a book, and you're taking it out on the road, and you're alone, you know, and you have your agent you can call, and you do have your friends, but it can be lonely. You write alone. So as often as you can, don't make it lonely. Make it a community effort. It's a good idea.
Danielle, thank you so much for being with us. This has been a great talk. I should have had you for an hour, but maybe we'll talk again after your book comes out.
That sounds good. Thanks, Barbara.
Thank you. That was Danielle Svetkov. She's with Levine Greenberg Rosten Literary Agency. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus. We stream live on KUCI.org. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher if you subscribe to Writers on Writing on iTunes. When we upload a show, after usually a couple of days after it airs, it will land in your podcast file, and you can listen from the start if you have only heard part. The first part of the show, I was with literary agent Danielle Svetkov, a literary agent with Levine Greenberg Rostin in New York. And now I'm back with Matt Coyle. Matt is the award-winning author of the best-selling Rick Cahill crime novels. He graduated with a degree in English from the University of California at Santa Barbara. Writing at night for more than a decade, his debut novel, Yesterday's Echo, was finally published in 2013 and won the Anthony Award for Best First Novel, the San Diego Book Award for Best Mystery, the Ben Franklin Award for Best New Voice in Fiction. He now has six in the series, published by Ocean View Books. Lost Tomorrows, Matt's sixth Rick Cahill novel, came out in December and has just been nominated for a Lefty Award. Yay! He lives in San Diego with his yellow lab, Angus, where he is writing his seventh crime novel. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Barbara. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, yeah. My pleasure. You know, I have to say that I often book writers before I read the book, and I've sort of stopped doing that because sometimes it doesn't work out so well. So now I feel like I have to read the book. I have to finish the book before I book anyone. And so I read yours, and as soon as I was done, I'm like, I have to talk to this guy. I have to talk to him. I love the book. It was really just a fast read and was also really instructive in terms of writing a mystery. I found that part of it really interesting too, your plotting and character development. I am curious how the book came about. How, you know, from series to series or from book to book within a series, like how does the next one come about? How did this one come about?
So when I was writing Yesterday's Echo, the first book in the series, the whole backstory and the whole drive for Rick is the death of his wife, which he was arrested for when he was a cop in Santa Barbara. He was never tried. He was released but never exonerated. And now, 14 years later, he's still thought to be, or he's at least the main suspect and probably thought to be a guy who got away with murder. So way back when I was writing this first book, I didn't realize I was writing a series until about halfway through. And once I got there, I realized, well, I've got to figure that. At some point, I got to tell the story of Colleen's murder, his ex-wife, his wife. But I didn't really think that much about it. She was a catalyst for me, for Rick, his whole adventure. But I didn't know exactly what happened to her. I didn't really care. And that, as a matter of fact, by the time I got to this book, book six, I was pretty much done with Colleen. Sorry, Colleen, but Rick wasn't. He never will be. But I had to come up with a book, and I was under contract, and the months were ticking off, and I was behind. And I'd just written an emotional book a couple years earlier in Blood Truth, where Rick learns the truth about his father. And while writing that book, or just before starting that book, I lost my own father. So it's kind of an emotional book for me. I didn't think I was really ready to get back into something so emotional, although all of Rick's books are emotional. But as I said, the clock is ticking. I'm under contract. I have to write a book. And so I said, and I was doing the What If series. I'm sure you've talked to authors before and you're writing yourself. And what if, you know, what if Rick does this and this happens? That's how sometimes I get ideas for books. And I was doing this, running out of time, and the only thing that kept coming back to me was, what if Rick goes to Santa Barbara and learns the truth about his wife, Colleen's death? Like I said, I didn't really want to write the damn book. I started writing it, and within 10 pages, I realized not only did I want to write the book, it was the book I needed to write, and it was the book I was meant to write all these years later. And I'm happy that I did. I'm happy that I was able to pull the emotion needed out to write the book.
So when you were writing your first, Yesterday's yeah. Echo, you hadn't intended to do a series?
No, I have a degree in English from UC Santa Barbara, which is a degree in English is good for if you want to go to law school, you want to teach, or you want to wait tables in a restaurant, which is what I did for years. And then, but I told myself, well, I'm going to be a writer. At some point, I'm going to write, and I never did for 30 years. I mean, I would start every once in a while when I was inspired, and of course, when you become a real writer, you realize inspiration is good for about 5 pages, and then the rest is work. But I decided that after I'd helped put the fourth golf company I worked for in 10 years out of business, I said, "Well, this is it. I've got to either write a book or stop talking about it." And so I just wanted to write a book. And then, like I said, halfway through, the more I learned about this character I was writing, I realized, well, this guy's got a really dark backstory. There's a lot to examine here. And then I realized, well, I was writing a series. But I still didn't know exactly what happened to Colleen, his dead wife.
Hmm. You know, it was interesting reading this because it's the first I've read of yours. And it's a series, but I didn't feel that I was, you know, kind of missing anything exactly. I mean, do you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't, yeah. It's not like a book that builds upon book where if you don't read the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth, you're not going to get the sixth. And I imagine going back to read your other work now, it will fill in gaps, but you know, I kind of like that. And how do you think about that then when you're writing a series? I mean, how do you write the sixth book in a series without having the reader be lost in terms of who the main character is, or what, you know, what the setting is or the problem?
Right. I try not to think too much about when I write, or about life in general, but, that is the one thing I really put a lot of thought into is how do I walk this line of spoiling things for new readers or boring old readers? And because I'm not writing, I'm not writing episodic series. I'm writing serialized where it continues on. There's a character arc. With Rick Cahill in particular, everything matters. Every bad decision he made in life, there's repercussions. So things do carry over from book to book. And so it's very delicate balance to try to give just enough for new readers to understand what's going on and not bore old readers. However, for this book, for Lost Tomorrows, I said to myself, well, now that I'm writing this book that I didn't want to write, that now I really want to write, the only way I can do it is not worry about new readers. This is a book for all the readers who've been with me from the first book or from wherever they came in to answer that question, the whole instigator for Rick's journey, what happened to his dead wife. And so I wrote the book not worrying about new readers, to be honest with you, because I thought I wasn't sure new readers will understand the darkness in Rick to get where he is to make some of the decisions he makes. But setting that aside, the book itself, like you said, is pretty much a standalone because the story is all told. Everything is encapsulated in this one story. And new readers will get enough of Rick and Colleen's backstory to understand what's happened before, and old readers will learn a little bit more about Rick and Colleen's relationship. And ironically, and I'm so happy you felt the same, the way that I've had other readers and new critiquers tell me that the book did work for them as a standalone, and they didn't feel left out. So it's funny. What's really taught me that is just write the book you think you need to write, and don't worry about the rest. But I'm really glad it worked out that way.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking right now about this book.
Right, right.
We might be talking about another one. So then, you know, you said you heard the first half of the show when I got you on. And yeah. Danielle was talking about how it's really hard to sell fiction. And yet, you know, this is your sixth book with Ocean View. Yeah. And it seems that writers of, you know, genre fiction have an easier time of it. And I don't know if that's ever something you considered when you started writing fiction or if you just started writing what you liked. And, you know, I take it you were a mystery reader before.
Right.
And
no, absolutely.
Yeah, talk about that. Talk about sort of the marketplace and writing in a market where, you know, agents will say it's difficult.
Yeah. And going back to it's Daniela, right?
Danielle,
Danielle, yeah. She's an agent, and some of the things she said about getting an agent, or everything she said about getting an agent, was so good, and I believe in everything she said. It's so instructive. So I hope I hope new writers or writers that have been trying to get published for a while really listen to what you had said, because there's really great information. I don't think there's anything easy about being a mystery writer, to be honest with you. It took me 10 years to get published, for my first book to get published. I think there are advantages to writing a series, because I think that is, at least in the mystery genre, I think that's initially what publishers want. My publisher only does one book on the first book. They don't sign you for two. They have right of first refusal. But then after I turned in my second book, Night Tremors, they started giving me two book deals, and they're pretty happy with what I do. So, you know, we have an ongoing relationship. But it is tough, and I think that I could definitely never write to what the market says I should write, or, you know, chase the market, because I don't think any reader should, because writing a book is hard, and to make it good, you really have to be interested in what you're doing and love what you're doing, and you have to love the genre. And what I would tell writers or beginning writers is to write the genre you read. I mean, you know, if you read a multiple of genres, fantastic. But what really gets into your soul, that's the only way you're going to be able to tell a good story, is if you're in love, although it is a love-hate relationship when you're writing. But you're more hate on my side. But you really have to care about what you're doing. You really have to be interested in what you're doing. And I, like you said, or you thought, I read crime fiction my entire life. Probably started with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Agatha Christie, and then when I got to the harder, the grayer writers like Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, and Ross McDonald, where I think when you're a kid, you really love the puzzle pieces and the right and wrong of, you know, Agatha Christie and Conan Doyle, where you fit the puzzle pieces in, and there's good people and bad people, and it makes perfect sense to you. But as you get a little older, as I got a little older, I like the idea of the grayness of the world and everything's not 100% good or bad, and sometimes the bad guys win. So that really informed my writing and piqued my interest. And I read crime genre almost exclusively, except if I'm reading nonfiction. I love the genre.
I have to ask you about names, because I think character names are really important. And there's one in this book, Landingham, that I was so curious about, because I wondered where it came from, because it's also the name of a character in West Wing. And so, the first couple of seasons, there's a character named Mrs. Landingham. Where did the name come from, and where do your names in general come from? How do you come up with them?
That is such a good question right now, because that is an interesting name. I did not watch West Wing. I was one of the few that didn't watch it. I have friends that read my books, and the woman who's cut my hair for probably 30 years, tell them that's old, man, 30 years, always says, why don't you put me in your book? She's always giving me a hard time. And her maiden name, last name, was Landingham.
Oh, interesting.
That's how she got in the book. But in general, names, I do find names very important to me. I really put a lot of effort into them. To me, there has to be sort of a rhythm to the name and kind of a feel type thing. But as you go along, as you write more books and you go to writers' conferences, which I love going to, and I suggest for any writer at any level to do, you will often at the conferences donate for the charity there someone who will bid to be their name in your next book.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times you are not, you know, that's only one or two names a book, but they start to add up. So a lot of times you are limited to some degree, and you want to, if someone's paying, you know, $300-$400 to have their name in your book, you don't want them just to be, you know, one character, or not obviously one character, but just like one line in the book. So I try to give them a little bit of weight. But that can be, you know, you don't want Tom Smith. you don't really want that name in your book. You want something more interesting. But I've been lucky. And then some people will give you a variety of names that you can use. And some people will say, well, you can use my middle name and such, so forth. But I do find names important. And I do like trying to find a place for people that donate to the charity. And then I always ask them, do you mind if you die and do you, horribly, and do you mind if you're a killer? And they usually say no. So they don't mind, so which is great.
That's funny. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Matt Coyle. We're talking about Lost Tomorrows, a Rick Cahill novel published by Ocean View. Now, talk about Ocean View a bit, because it's a smaller press, yeah?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, there's such wonderful smaller presses happening right now, I think. And
yeah.
I became aware of Ocean View through your book. And
great.
How'd you find them?
Well, my agent found them after, you know, getting an agent is probably as hard as getting published. I, like I said, probably it took me 5 years once I started submitting and then pulling back, revising, submitting. And then Kimberly Cameron, my agent, was able to get a deal with Ocean View within about 6 or 7 months. But what I love about Ocean View is that, first of all, they listen. They talk to me. They listen to me. I have some input with some things that I might not have a bigger publisher. And they do a very good job with pre-pub publicity. They really work hard at that. And they're really getting good at social media, too. Obviously, there's, you know, some drawbacks being with a smaller publisher in terms of distribution and in terms of money, of course. But they really do a good job of promoting their authors, and they're really good people to work with, and good editing. So it's been a good experience.
So when you say it took you a while to get an agent, I mean, would you send out and get responses and then tweak your manuscript and then send out again, or how would that go for you?
Yeah, what I did, and I took the advice of a woman I've worked with for years named Carolyn Wheat, who's a
mystery.
You know Carolyn?
Yeah, she was on the show years ago.
Oh, well, she leads the writers group I've been in for a long time, and she has a lot of wisdom. She says, well, you know, make a list of your A, B, and C agents, and you know, A's are probably New York houses. And first of all, you do your homework. You get on, there's a great avenue or reservoir of information called Publishers Marketplace, which I think is about $25 a month now. So you get on that, and it's a website. It'll tell you who's publishing what agents are with what authors, and it's really great resource for learning all that stuff. So, but I would, and sometimes when you're a starting author, you figure, well, you know, I don't know if I'm good enough for this and that. But you got to realize you're in the marketplace now. You're competing against Michael Connelly and Robert Crace. So you got to shoot for the stars. Don't be afraid. You know, shoot for the very top agent. You find out what the writers you like, who their agents are, and you go and shoot for them. And then they probably ignore you or reject you. Sometimes you'll get an actual rejection that says, I liked your work, but it's not right for me at this time. I actually had an agent in L.A. who was a nice lady. You might know her, Betsy Amster.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, well, she rejected an early draft on Yesterday's Echo, and I had a few emails back and forth with her because she was really nice, and this, you can get an agent to do that after they reject you. It's fantastic. But she was trying to cheer me up at one point, and I think she said, I think she was trying to cheer me up. She said, well, you know, Jonathan Kellerman, it took him to his sixth or seventh novel before he's published. And I thought, well, that was very sweet, but I was 50 at the time, and I didn't know how much longer I was going to live. So I appreciated the opportunity to bully me. But, yeah, you just have to stay at it. And I actually, and what your agent had on earlier said, which happens to a lot of authors, is I met my agent at a writer's conference.
Mm-hmm.
You'll often have the opportunity to send pages in ahead of time, a read and critique, and hopefully if you get hooked on with an agent to read you, that you meet with them and they'll talk to you for a little bit, and hopefully they'll ask for more, and that's what happened with Kimberly. And what your agent said earlier is the idea of meeting them, and then when you submit to them later via email, you're not stuck in the slush fund because, you, like she said, I'm the person with the British accent, blah, blah, blah. And they remember you, and they will at least give you a read. So it really does matter going to those conferences.
And speaking of conferences, Left Coast Crime is coming up in San Diego in March. And I plan to be there. And I know you are either a keynote or you are something. What are you there?
I'm a Toastmaster.
Toastmaster.
I think they... I think for all the morning breakfasts, they give me like four or five toasters, and then I've got to work with avocado and shrimp to make some shrimp and avocado toast or something. But
well,
I'll be there.
Yeah, I can't wait. I haven't been to a Left Coast Crime in years, and I'm just really excited about being there again. And it kind of moves around, right? I mean, it's not always San Diego. It's
No. It hasn't been San Diego, I think, since the 90s. You go to a lot of great locations. And, of course, San Diego in March is a good place to be, I think, if you're coming from the East Coast or something.
Yeah, it's priced well. You can find it leftcoastcrime.org, I believe. And anyway, so I'll look forward to that. But we are running out of time, and I wondered if you had any last words or advice for the novelists listening.
I do have advice, and if everyone's already heard it, is get your butt in the seat and write. You have to write. You have to write when it's easy. You have to write when it's hard. You have to write when there's nothing in your head to write. You got to stare at the monitor and squeeze out some blood. The only way you're going to get better is writing. And the other thing I would say is your first draft, when you finished it, that very first draft, your very first book that you're very proud of, is going to be horrible, so you need to revise.
Revision, of course.
Yeah.
Matt, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you. I had a great time.
And I'll
bloviating.
Thank you so much. I'll see you soon.
All right, take care.
That was Matt Coyle. His book is Lost Tomorrows, and Left Coast Crime, check it out. Sponsored by Sisters in Crime, a nonprofit. So Sisters in Crime is an organization that supports women crime writers. We have lots of men as members, and we have a monthly meeting here in Irvine, California. You can find out about that by going to the website ocsistersincrime.org or email me, and I'll tell you more. That was Matt Coyle. We had Danielle Svetkov on the first half, and we will podcast this show in a few days. So subscribe to Writers on Writing and listen again. And I thank you for being with us. And as Matt said, you have to keep yourself in the chair to get writing done. And if you have a standing desk, well, you have to stand before that desk and get writing done. Thanks so much for being with us.